Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Progressively Incorrect. My name is Zach Groeschel, and I am so excited today to be talking to John Mighton all about math. And as you know, this podcast is sponsored by John Catt Educational, which publishes some of the best books in education, including my own book, Just Tell Them, The Power of Explanations and Explicit Teaching. But that's just a plug for myself because there's a ton of John Catt books that I will link in the show notes. Check them out and start your evidence-informed journey. Oh, there's books about math and there's books about science. There's books about all aspects of teaching. Check those out. John, it is so great to have you on the podcast. Finally, how are you doing?
Great. I'm very excited to talk to you today. I'm a big admirer of your work.
Likewise. And we just met at Research Ed Toronto very recently. But let's start with this question. What's a moment in your career that kind of made you question how we teach math and sparked your interest in changing it?
I think there were two turning points, both personal. I almost failed math, and I was also a terrible writer when I was younger. And in my 20s, I read Sylvia Plath, she's an American poet, Letters to Her Mother. And it was clear she trained herself to write. You know, she wrote imitations of other poets. She memorized poems. She read everything she could about the structure of poems. And until then, I didn't think there was anything I could do to train myself. I thought I just had to be born with talent in math or writing. And so I started imitating her poems and other poets, and eventually published and got into theater. And I've had a career in theater. My plays have been done in many countries. But it came from, you know, zero talent. And that was one turning point. The second is I started tutoring to make a bit of money when I was starting out as a playwright. I figured I could tutor lower grades because I did pass calculus, didn't do too well in it. And that was a turning point because explaining things to the kids at my own pace, things that seemed mysterious to me in high school became more and more obvious. And one of my first students was in a remedial grade six class. And his mom had been told that he could never learn math. He was just too challenged. So he's a fully tenured math professor now. And I saw the same thing with students when we started Jump. Jump was first just a tutoring club. One girl was, they thought her IQ was 70. She was testing at grade one level. I'd never seen a kid that challenged in grade six. 3 years later, she went into academic grade nine math and she skipped a year. So I just started seeing these remarkable changes in students when they were given the right attention, and also in myself as I was teaching them, I began to be more and more confident in math. So those two things made me think, how is it possible that, you know, I did so badly in these subjects and now I have a doctorate in math and so on, and how is it possible that these kids are falling through the cracks who are capable of doing very high level math? That's what set me on this journey.
It's interesting because I think for reading, there's a sense of urgency when it comes to a child sort of, you know, demonstrating that they can't read on level or showing that they struggle. And we really empathize with that. With math, I feel like there should just be a direct parallel there but we often don't apply some of those same lessons that we take from reading to math. I mean, I see a lot of times when we talk about math that, you know, there's math people and there's math identity and there's certain things that are wrapped up in math. But what I'm hearing from you saying is a lot of, that perhaps we should address it by like with instruction. I mean, was that what you were finding when in the early days?
Yeah. And you kind of hinted at something, you know, there's been a real sense of urgency in reading, but not in math, because I think people think I could get by without math. I survived, but they never ask, what did I lose? How much did I lose by not having math? And there's now research showing that, you know, for kindergarten kids, math is a stronger predictor of success at school than any other subject, including reading. So, and at all grade levels, it's a barrier to success, to degree completion. So I don't think people are aware of how important math is. And beyond that, there's new research showing math can even change executive function if you're taught math well. Kids who don't get good math, adolescents lack a neurotransmitter that helps them solve problems in all domains. People just have no clue about how much kids are losing. And what struck me also was, you know, we've had trouble building sustainable economies and fair economies, and we've had trouble eradicating material poverty. But when I saw these kids within weeks changing and becoming great learners and so on, and we began to see this in Jump later in whole classrooms where kids would get so excited about succeeding together, I realized that math is an incredible tool for equity, more so than any other subject. I do a lot of demo lessons where I'll go into a class anywhere from even up into high school, and usually can get all the kids engaged in one lesson and know how to quickly bring them up to grade level. That would be impossible in reading. I could never do that in reading. Close the gap that quickly. So I don't think when I'm talking about the losses that we incur by not teaching kids according to their potential in math, we have, we really don't even have any clue how big those losses are. Because if you can equalize a class within a day, a week, and make all the kids feel capable and smart, it has a spillover into every aspect of their life. And I don't think there's any other subject outside of math where you can do that so quickly. So that gave me a sense of urgency around trying to figure out what needs to change in teaching, and so that we stop leaving so many kids behind.
And there's a lot of kind of, I think, misunderstandings about what constitutes high quality math instruction today. What would you say are some of those misconceptions?
Yeah, that's a really complex question, and we'll probably keep coming back to it. We want Jump produces great results in problem solving, including on randomized controlled trials. But it's sometimes hard to convince people of that, even if you show them that data, because we start a couple grades below grade level. We find very efficient there. I'm a mathematician, and a lot of our writers are logicians. There are very efficient paths you can follow to get up to grade level in any subject that would shock people. But because we start below grade level, because we use a lot of scaffolding in the first part of the year, because we are trying to build confidence and so on, people think, well, that's not really a problem-solving course, in spite of the data we put in front of them, like randomized controlled trials with high effect sizes. And it's because they keep mistaking the end of education, where you want to get kids to, with the means to get there or the path you want to follow. They keep treating kids like they're expert learners who can handle these rich, complex problems right off the bat. And that's where Jump gets to, but you have to have a much more incremental approach where you increase the level of difficulty more gradually. You help kids build schemas or mental representations so that they don't have to work so hard. They can just look at things and see patterns and see connections. Sometimes I use the analogy of, I don't know if you've ever tried to play chess against people who play on the streets, like in New York. I wouldn't recommend it. I just get slaughtered all the time. And I'm a mathematician, and I can hold a lot in my head, but these guys on the street just cream me. And so why is that? And they're not even grandmasters. It's because they've built so much expertise in chess, and they can see patterns and just look at the board when I'm laboring to go through one pathway after another. That's why I can't compete with them. So they're experts, I'm a novice, and we keep treating kids like they're experts, whereas it takes years of training to build up that automaticity in chess and those mental schemas where you can just see what to do and how to solve a problem. So that's one huge mistake. I think it's changing. Like, people are suddenly starting to realize that kids do need more guidance and scaffolding. There's two other problems that aren't really on people's radars. I don't know. I don't want to go on and on, but with motivation, I met you at Research Ed, and it's a fantastic conference series organized by teachers and where they get great cognitive scientists to come and speak and psychologists. I heard two researchers at Research Ed say, everybody thinks we have to kind of hide the math or do anything we can to get kids engaged in math because it's a boring subject, it's a hard subject. So you might do special projects on something kids interested in, and there's nothing wrong with that. But if you think that that is going to lead to achievement, so you do anything you can to get the kids engaged in math, hoping you'll one day have success. They'll have one success. These two scientists both said the arrow goes way more the other way. From if kids have success in anything, they become engaged. And I saw an article a while ago in Nature Communications called the 85% rule for optimal learning. And they argue there's a lot of evidence that we are happiest and most engaged, and we also our brains work most efficiently when we've almost got something. We're about 85% proficient. We just have to stretch ourselves a bit. It's also called the Goldilocks zone or the zone of proximal development. There's lots of names sort of around the same thing. Not too hard, not too easy. If kids are in that zone and allowed to practice in that zone, then they have deep engagement. I mean, apparently, I'm not a neurologist, but apparently they're using the dopamine reward for being in that zone. And I've seen it. I've seen kids cheer for math. I broke up a fight once by telling the bully if he didn't apologize, I wouldn't give him his bonus question, and he apologized. So kids just love mastering things, being in that zone where they're having success, where it looks a little hard. And so I don't think we really understand engagement at all as adults or what engages kids. I once did a demo lesson in a very violent school with behavioral kids in Brixton, and taught some pretty dry lessons. One was on operations with fractions. When I came in on the third lesson, the kids cheered. Kids were considered unteachable just because they were in that zone all the time. So that's another big mistake we make around engagement. We don't really understand the research and motivation and engagement. And there's a big Canadian study that just showed the arrow goes much more that other way. And then finally, this one's not on anyone's radar. Everybody thinks to solve real world problems, you give the kids lots of real world problems, rich story problems, highly contextualized. There's an article that came out in Science Magazine 15 years ago by Kaminsky and her colleagues called The Advantages of Abstract Examples in Learning Math. They did a study where one group of kids learned a concept using measuring cups, the other abstract symbols, and the group that used abstract symbols did much better at transferring the knowledge to new situations. And she and other researchers have done research right from pre-K right up to university level, showing that in many cases, it's better either to start with a more abstract or schematic representation and add context, add complexity, or even if you start with some kind of real-world context, fade as quickly, it's called concreteness fading, fade as quickly as possible to a more abstract representation. I'm not aware of many people in education who know that work, or if they're judging a textbook or any kind of online product, would be asking, does it have the right progression in some cases from abstract to concrete? You can't even get, in many states, you can't, according to the review criteria they're using for programs, you could not get a pass. If you were actually structured that way, where you started with more abstract or schematic representations that showed the deep structure of the problem or the concept and moved to instantiations, you couldn't get a pass. I know because we've had that problem in Jump.
I want to talk about that with you for a while because also I didn't know you were going to bring this up, but now I'm going to let it's time to nerd out. I think about this. Absolutely, right? And so and you're dealing with this problem that exists in education in general, which is that these states or provincial lists are often the barrier to getting evidence-based programs into the province or the state, which doesn't make any sense, right? Right now we're having this experience with reading in particular. After sold a story, there's just like these state lists and they give you five things, and guess what? Four of those five things are trash, but they're on the list. And what about these other
That's right.
ones, right?
That's right.
You gave one example of this for math, which is that we don't quite know enough about how to select examples, but we do know something, and it may go against the prevailing wisdom of how to sequence examples. But then there's a rubric maybe designed, and they assess the quality of the program on the basis of that rubric item, and it actually generates a list of worst programs. How
That's
do
right.
we solve this problem? This is something I've been thinking about for a long time.
Yeah, it's I think one of the most serious problems that people are facing in US education, and funders are also funding things that are not well aligned with the science of learning. Because they look good. They're rich problem-solving based programs. All those. What would the opposite be? A poor program, like a rich authentic problem. The opposite would be a poor inauthentic problem. So we're even seduced by the language and funders, especially who don't have expertise in the science of learning. It's a crisis. Nothing will change in the U.S. unless that changes. We are seeing some evidence through the people we meet at Research Ed, for instance, that districts are willing to forego those rubrics and lists and take programs that have evidence. So I'm a bit kind of optimistic because of movements like Research Ed, but so many problems could be solved if there was some expertise in the system that would say, your definition of rigor, for instance, where rigor means like a lot of those rubrics have program has to be rigorous, has to have applications. It's a real problem if you expect right from day one, kids are going to be working with rich, real world, authentic problems. It's not only is it going to be terribly inefficient cognitively, but here's another thing no one's taken account of from what I've seen. As early as grade one, there's research showing kids know where they are in a hierarchy. Anthropologists call humans status-seeking primates. If we're born with any abilities to know where we're, I don't think it's math. Math, I don't think is innate, or the tiniest component would be innate, but definitely we can recognize where we are in a hierarchy very early. And so what if a kid decides in grade one they're not in the talented group? We ask teachers that when we train them, and teachers always say, well, they'll stop engaging. They'll start falling behind because they're not engaging. They'll start getting anxious. They'll start distracting the class or misbehaving. There's all kinds of things that happen. And once they fall behind in math, unless their parents can hire a tutor, it's not that likely they're going to catch up. So if your definition, if your rubrics that you're using to certify programs demand that you treat kids like experts right from the beginning of the year, you're not only going to have so many kids, it's happening across the states, not able to learn efficiently, but you're going to have huge problems with engagement and motivation because once you have hierarchies in the classroom, half the class is just going to turn off and it's very hard to get them back again. So those rubrics are doing terrible damage across the states. And it's not just the rubrics, it's the people who are interpreting them may not have a background in cognitive science. And it's also stopping any kind of innovation or experimentation. We offer free pilots or highly subsidized pilots to school districts where you can actually see for yourself. Just test, why would you dump only one program on teachers, as we always do, with very little evidence beyond the fact that it meets the rubric? Why would you not want to run more than one program and test them? If the rubrics are in place, schools can't even do that because we're not on the list. So anyway, I don't want to be too negative because I think things are changing quickly. Thanks to Sold a Story and other, the movement in reading. I think we're starting to see more and more appetite among district leaders, math consultants, and so on. There's more and more appetite for experimentation and exploring other approaches to teaching math.
One of the things I think is that we've embraced the idea, at least in because thanks to phonics programs, I believe there's been a spillover effect that there's less negativity towards programs. And I feel like especially elementary teachers are just perfectly positioned and poised to take what they've learned from a really systematic program in phonics and transfer it to math. However, again, the negativity comes back in. You get a lot of these questions around about fidelity, around how much can I pick and choose, how much is my autonomy being put into question. What are some of your answers around that?
Yeah, that's a really, really deep question. We're working with one of our partners. We have a lot of research partners. One is the University of Calgary Workland School of Education, and we formed a partnership called Math Minds with them. And Brent Davis, who's like one of my heroes, he's not only an educator, but he also knows the science. He once said, we're going to put Jump out of business. And so now when he gives talks, he says he realized something that he didn't at the time, that no matter how much great professional learning you give teachers, no matter how much they internalize these principles, they don't really have time to invent these pathways or define these efficient pathways. They can't pull lessons off teacher pay teachers because a lot of those are not, studies have shown they're not high quality. And also, how do you know that lesson fits with the next one or that you're taking the most efficient pathway? And so he realized that he says now that professional development has to be a partnership between a resource, a really strong resource, and the teacher. And the resource helps the teacher unravel the concepts and ravel them back together in the most efficient ways. But the responsibility keeps swinging. Once the teacher, for instance, has some good Socratic questions to ask and so on, they're using their expertise. They're observing their kids. They're thinking, do I have to explain this differently? Do I have to slow down or speed up? Do I need to give some bonus questions so I can spend a little time with the kid? Once you are empowered with knowing the math and having a great resource, it frees you up to focus on the achievement of your students and the engagement of your students. So it's a beautiful partnership when teachers get the right support.
Absolutely. A lot of these things we're talking about kind of goes back to teacher training and especially pre-service teacher training. And I know that we're both mutual friends of Anna Stocke, and we're seeing some of the same things in Canada that's happening in the US. If you could redesign this kind of this how we develop teachers and pre-service teachers, what would you do? What would you keep? What would you throw out?
Well, I think there's many valuable things like the practical experience that passed on to teachers, practicums, being able to go and work in classrooms. I think a couple of things that may be missing are when we train teachers, we give them this problem that a lot of grade six teachers struggle with. It was off a provincial exam in Ontario. You got two towns. In one town, there's 36 kids, and the ratio of girls to boys is 4 to 5. This was in the days when people were not sensitive about gender, so I'm just telling you the actual problem. In the other town, it's 40% girls, 45 kids. And we just asked teachers, what's the easiest approach to either of these problems? And sometimes it's a struggle. Like some teachers will give a very highly abstract approach, like I would add the two terms of the ratio and then divide the number of kids by that and multiply each term by that. It's rare that teachers would actually just draw a picture of the town, like four girls, five boys, four girls, five boys. Because we're so used to just doing these calculations we don't understand. So we give that problem to show teachers that if you go back to the right level, eventually you could understand that higher level explanation just from that picture. Everything in that method is right in that picture. And we just ask teachers a few Socratic questions. They figure it out themselves because we want them to feel they could do anything. Some teachers take a different approach. They'll try and make a fraction, like four girls to five boys. What do you think the most common mistake there would be if you've got four girls to five boys and I say, what fraction are boys?
Oh, they
Or girls, sorry, what fraction are girls? Four girls, five boys, what fraction are girls? If there's,
five.
yeah,
Yeah,
yeah.
yeah.
So, and some teachers even say it's 80%, and they're
Right,
very
right,
proud.
right, right,
But you need the whole, you need the total number of kids as your denominator, like it's 4 over 9. And I'm not criticizing teachers. Teachers are my absolute heroes. Jump would not exist without teachers because they fought to get it into their classrooms. They've taught us how to improve it. They volunteer for us because we're a charity. Teachers are my absolute heroes. People don't know how hard it is to be a teacher. But many teachers, through no fault of their own, they just have never been taught the math. And so they love it when they realize all the mistakes they make and all of these pathways they can learn in literally 40 minutes. Like you can learn about four different approaches to this problem that are so deep that you're not even multiplying by the percent, because you're not saying 40% is 0.4 times 45, the number of kids. Teachers actually learn to think about it more deeply. They could convert that 40% into a part ratio, like the other town. So that takes 40 minutes for them to discover about four different approaches, and they can even evaluate which ones are the simplest. Where would I start? So that's the ability teachers have in a really rough topic, a difficult topic that takes up, several weeks in usually in the curriculum, and that many kids, it's the end of them in math. So how's that happening? Like really, when teachers say, "How come we don't know this?" This is just so trivial and clear, and we can get to the foundations, the conceptual foundations of this, the deepest level in this in 40 minutes. So that's the first thing I'd change in teachers' college. Give teachers that experience where they can understand the math deeply in a difficult-looking topic and understand how to scaffold, how to break things into chunks, and how to inspire the kids by keeping them in that 85% zone and keeping themselves there. I think they're, you can never teach them all of the math, but you can give them a taste of it so that they could recognize a good resource or potentially even fix a lesson themselves, things like that.
We have this problem, however, with especially elementary teaching, that they're not subject experts in math, and they tend to come, because I'm an elementary teacher, so I'm speaking of my people. We tend to come from maybe humanities and kind of love of literature and things like that, and we just like kids, right? So we might not even have any specific subject expertise in any of the subjects. One of the solutions I've heard of is that you have a math specialist starting in like fourth or fifth grade. I mean, is this a way to do this? Do you think it's as the kids get to more and more sophisticated math, are we asking too much of elementary teachers to be to learn this math?
That's a good question. The answer is yes and no. Specialists are fantastic. It's great to have them. But given the limited resources in the system and so on, teachers need specialists now in the present system. But if you actually gave them a good resource that they could use, we found they can learn them out. So we wrote very detailed lesson plans for the teachers. And JUMP is based on a method called structured inquiry, where it's kind of the best of both worlds. It's a form of explicit instruction because the kids are being very guided, but a lot of it's Socratic questions, so the kids feel they're figuring it out. And so it's a balance of inquiry, but very structured and guided by the teacher. We found we had there was a pair of really math phobic teachers in British Columbia in Canada. There was an article about them in the provincial paper. Who one thought she was a fraud teaching math. One cried herself to sleep at teachers' colleges. She was so terrified of math. After using JUMP for a couple of years and following these lesson plans, they felt they knew the math so well. They went on and did masters in math education, and they're training other teachers. So, just like any kid can learn math almost without exception, same with teachers. What we did find, like you have to be in the trenches with teachers to find these things. Like a lot of programs just dump, they're just sales machines, and they dump things on people that don't work, and then they move on and create a new product that's going to come out when that one is clearly failing. That's the cycle we've seen over and over again. But we're, as a charity, we can be in classrooms, we can be doing demo lessons, we're working with teachers. We found that even our teachers' guides were too overwhelming for teachers. They just don't have time. So we created slides where all the questions they have to ask, all the diagrams and assessments, because there's a lot of continuous assessment in JUMP, they're there on the slides. They can project them on PowerPoint, or they can plan with them if they don't want to do that. But they have the lesson at their fingertips. And we found if you don't do that, teachers just don't have time to learn the math or the pedagogy. And so that's, I think, I don't think districts, if they really invested in supporting teachers as they are at all levels, the teachers could learn the math deeply and love it. I mean, these two teachers I mentioned, math became their favorite subject, partly because of the effect you can have on kids in math, partly because it's a beautiful subject.
I feel that that's so intuitively true because when I give examples, like I do demo lessons or whatever, right, I'm just going like, oh yeah, I memorized this example from a previous resource when I was first teaching, right? And I've talked to teachers who have not had any resources, but they're excellent teachers, and they just tell me like, it's just because I memorized my old one. Like right? And I'd love to see more research coming into that, where basically it's like the invisible effects of using a really systematic program on teachers' subject knowledge. I think it would just
That's right.
be so impactful.
Yeah, I agree.
So one of the things we're seeing that's in Canada and it's happening also in the United States, we're seeing certain reforms that are a little bit slower in math than they are in reading, but we're watching something's kind of bubbling up right now. Me, I've worked in several schools in Canada now too, where I'm sort of learning by province what's going on. So what signs, we've alluded to this a little bit, but what signs of progress are there? Like, what are you seeing as in terms of like the next phase of this movement around evidence-based math education?
Well, because of the research in reading and the changes in reading, people are realizing, as you suggested earlier, that having a structured program is not a bad thing. people are realizing that foundational knowledge is important, that you can't be a problem solver or reader without foundation knowledge. Those are two great shifts, and they're huge, because before people just thought, well, kids are just, you just throw rich problems out and kids are going to find their path, and the ones who don't get them, and that's just not the subject for them. That's really the attitude of underlying a lot of programs. So those are really good things. Also, the gatekeepers in many districts are math consultants or sometimes superintendents, but often just the math consultants, math leads, math experts. And we're finding at Research Ed there's been a sea change in the kind of people who are getting in those positions. They really are interested in evidence. They're becoming experts in the science of learning, partly because they saw the shift in reading. So those are really good things. The things we need, I think, we need to accelerate that, and we need to also have more standards in place where boards will actually test programs and more rigorously. That's not hard to track kids. Like in Canada, there's now developed by University of Carleton, there's a math screener. The AIM network has developed a math screener for kids from K to four. It's easy to administer, and it's not hard to track kids. Or in the US, one of the great things about the US, people might think I'm crazy saying this, but you have state tests every year. In Canada, we don't, our tests happen every 3 years, so it's impossible to track progress. So boards should be looking at those tests more and saying, if things aren't shifting, and if it's possible that all kids could learn math, we must be doing something wrong, and we better keep looking. So that's one thing we could work on more. Like, for instance, are you aware of the research on abstract versus concrete? And are you giving teachers resources that are aligned with that? Those are some of the, I think, the things we need to work harder on.
Absolutely. And across all of the topics that I talk about, math ends up being the most controversial. Like, I know that people that even come onto this one, they're going to find something that really they don't want their teachers to hear about because they sort of bought into this existing ideology. I would like to see a cooling down a little bit of some of the tempers in the math space. I'm finding it to be I feel like we've kind of come to some consensus in reading, but math is just the wild, wild west, it really feels like.
I don't I that's an interesting issue you raise. That's a real challenge in math, because I was asked to speak to education writers in Texas. And I think I got the invitation because of Holly Corby. She's one of my heroes too. And everybody at that conference, all the writers were trying to figure out what is this equivalent in math to sold a story in reading? Like, what is a story in math that would grab people's attention? And they kept realizing it's very hard in math, because in sold a story, the message is kids need phonics, decoding, and that can be taught rigorously. There were even kind of villains they could point to who had persuaded teachers not to do that. There's no similar story in math. It's so diffuse. There are about three or four strands in the research you need to take account of, like on motivation, on abstract versus concrete, on that 85% zone. There's no silver bullet like with phonics, but you can design a program we found pretty easily that takes care of those trends in the research, or is aligned with those, but it's not an easy story to tell. And also, because so many people found math boring, hard, and so on, they keep falling for people who say, "Oh, you got to do anything you can to get kids engaged that's not math itself," or people who say, "Oh, just throw out a rich problem and let kids find their levels," because math is inherently hard, so kids are, and you don't want to bore the faster kids, even though in an equalized classroom, the faster kids go further with everybody. But the idea is you don't want to bore faster kids, or math is inherently hard for some kids. So just, it doesn't matter if kids are, not succeeding at rich problems. It's the vast majority will never succeed at rich problems. And that's just, I can't even tell you how tragic that is. We had one teacher, her work was reported in the New York Times. It's an article called "The Better Way to Teach Math," I think, by David Bornstein. She took a very average grade five class with some very weak students, like kids 3 years behind, four kids on special education plans. Within 2 years, they all wrote the Pythagoras math competition, and all but three got awards of distinction. So that's the potential in kids, and I've seen it over and over again. We've seen teachers who can reproduce that, turn a weaker average class into a class that looks like a gifted class without leaving kids behind. What if that was the standard? We shouldn't be debating, can we shift the bell curve a bit or close the gap a bit? What if we expected all kids to be, or almost without exception, and I've taught some insanely challenged kids. The vast majority of kids should be doing math at a high level and loving it. Okay, if that's our standard, we have to reevaluate everything. Stop these stupid debates. Look to the science. Run studies and keep run pilots in your districts until you get teachers able to do it at that level. It's just tragic the potential we're wasting in our society in mathematics.
It just doesn't make any sense to me that even if you did experience a lot of suffering and anxiety around math yourself, which I did for like I'm one of those people who was like, yeah, I said in my first math class when I was in school, I was like, if I can help it, I'm not going to teach this subject. Like, if I can
Right.
figure out a way to not have
Yeah.
to teach math, I'll do it, right?
Yeah.
But I think that the shift with me was like, well, because I can empathize with someone who hates this
Yeah.
stuff, that I can teach the hell out of it, right?
Yeah.
And I don't
Yeah.
know why that's not embraced. Why is it that because you struggled, that kids should experience a type of math that's not even, where's the
Yeah.
math, right? You know,
Yeah.
why would we gut it of what makes it math? That doesn't seem like the right response to me. It seems
Yeah.
like I want to make you be a kid not know they're eating their vegetables and
Right.
actually have a
Right.
great time, you know?
Yeah. Like that. So I think we're very similar because I think that's why I thought so much about these things because I struggled. And I don't feel, even though I'm a mathematician, I don't feel I understand. I still have a kind of anxiety. I don't feel I understand anything unless I can reduce it to concepts that or skills that a very young child could understand. I can teach calculus that way because I had to teach myself that way. So when you struggle, you can sometimes make a great teacher, but you also need help because there's one study that came out where they found that elementary kids often tend to internalize the anxiety of a teacher of the same sex. So girls will internalize the anxiety of a female teacher, and boys will internalize the anxiety of a male teacher. You know, unfortunately, as I said, teachers are my heroes, but there's a lot of elementary school teachers who are math phobic females. And the study found that that is disproportionately harming girls because they're picking up on these anxieties and stereotypes from their teachers. So it's not enough just to have struggled in math to become a good teacher, because I think people who struggle do become great teachers when the light goes on. You have to have support to do that. You have to, and particularly it's really urgent with girls. Girls are doing better at schools and boys, from what I understand, but they don't think they are, and they're picking up on stereotypes. They don't sometimes go on in math, and I think partly it's because the teachers are not projecting this idea that anyone can learn math.
That's one of the things I think is important to hold in mind as we kind of have these discussions, is that the same with balanced literacy. It's like that some of the things that the other side is saying is true, right? It's like I think that math is not seen by a lot of kids as something that they can do.
Right.
However, we have to combine some of these motivational aspects
Yeah.
with the instructional design that enables kids to succeed at math, because it's broken down in a granular way, it builds up in a
That's
scaffolded
right.
way, they get enough sufficient practice so that they
Right.
don't forget it. We have to combine instruction with some of the things people are advocating for, which is just
Right.
the motivational pieces.
Yeah. Well, here's an example, like that class I mentioned in Brixton with the grade six behavioral kids. I was pretty terrified teaching that lesson because not because I was worried about the kids were violent. I wasn't worried about that, but I thought this is going to be a massive failure. I don't know how I'll keep their attention. So I decided to teach them how to read binary codes, like to translate between strings of zeros and ones and regular numbers and back and forth. The kids figured out how to go both ways. They said, and you can teach that if the kids can add on their fingers. You can teach the code. The kids thought they were little code breakers. They wanted longer and longer codes. And then there's a beautiful mind reading trick you can do where you put up some charts on the board and you say, I'm going to leave the room. I want you to one kid to write a number on the board, and then I'm going to come back in and I'm going to read your minds. And so you say, is the number on this chart, on this chart? And what the kids realize eventually, when they're saying yes and no, they're giving you the number in binary code. The yes is one, no is zero. And when that light goes on, they all want to come up and do the trick, like the kids, and they want to take it home to show their parents. So, but it was, but so there was a great application there. There was a bit of magic. So I'm not saying you don't only teach, you don't only teach to success and keep kids in that zone, although that's enough, we found. But you can do all kinds of things to show them the beautiful applications of math. But in that lesson, the weakest kid could participate if they could add on their fingers. So you can design lessons like that where kids can see really interesting, deep applications, but everyone can come along for the ride.
Absolutely. And too often, I mean, these tasks just leave the bottom quartile
That's
out.
right.
And you know what I
That's
mean? And
right.
that's to
Exactly.
me just completely unfair. John, we're coming towards the end of our discussion. You've mentioned Jump and some of, you know, and your charity and some of the opportunities there. I just want to give you an opportunity to like explain to you know, my audience how they can get in contact with you and how they can learn more.
Well, we have a website in both the US and Canada, jumpmath.org. People can get in touch through there. We'd love to find districts or schools that want to pilot these ideas. We can often help with the cost of that or subsidize that heavily for pilots. Although we're affordable compared to other programs, even without those discounts. There's also, I just did a course with Barbara Oakley, who's very popular on Coursera, a Coursera course called Making Math Click. So if you want to learn more about the science of learning, how the brain works, that course is available. We also on the Jump website have lots of resources. All the research that we've done in Jump is there on the website. There's sample lessons people can get on the website and try it out. So we are starting to grow more quickly now in the US. It's quite exciting to us, and we're getting district adoptions and so on. So we've also, if you're worried about state tests, we had a school in Manhattan that got the greatest gains on the New York state tests of all schools in New York City in the year they adopted Jump. And it's that was reported in Chalkbeat. And in Brooklyn, we did a study where there was in some, I think the average gains are about 15 percentage points in a year in the schools. So we've got some great evidence. So if schools are want to try and show a shift in state tests, I actually like the US state tests. I think they're very well designed, and it's, you know, if kids aren't prepared for them, it's a tragedy. But they're well designed, and they're a good way of measuring impact. So if we work with the district, we would hope we could show an effect in a year. So we're looking for partners there.
Excellent. And I'll put some of that information in the show notes for listeners. John Mighton, it's just been a great opportunity to be able to talk to you on the podcast. Listeners, thank you so much for tuning in to Progressively Incorrect. I'm going to keep on, you know, churning out these episodes basically on a weekly basis. So if you could share this with a principal, with a superintendent, with a colleague, and give this a 5-star rating on the platform of your choosing, that would really help this show out. John, thank you so much for coming on, and I hope we can speak soon about, you know, our big future plans to change the world.
Yeah, thank you. It's a real privilege to talk to you, and I really admire the work you're doing. So, thank you. Thanks so much.